say, I actually had a lot of trouble last night. I wanted to try and sort of try and think about topics that I thought were exciting just to talk about on the frontiers. And I realized there were too many things in gravity that I thought were exciting. So I sort of, you know, was sitting there, shall I talk about this? And I'd start thinking about, no, I should talk about that. So in the end, I've settled on trying to discuss in the first part of the lecture just two things. One, you know, pretty much at polar opposite ends of the spectrum as far as gravity is concerned. So the title of today's lecture is Gravity Today. Now, that's not some sort of cheap magazine that, you know, I'm trying to set up or anything. It's really just meant to represent, you know, this notion of where, you know, where things are happening in gravity today. And you know, from in the past lectures, what we've done in this course is we've taken what you know about general relativity and sort of stepped it up to a new level. We looked at mathematics, so we kind of developed the language of manifolds to see, you know, what we could import from mathematics that might be helpful. So, you know, we laid up that formalism from differential geometry. We got some tools like the Cartan formalism, which I'm a particular fan of, in case you hadn't noticed, and Gauss-Kadatze, the geometry of submanifolds, which is particularly important in a sort of contemporary context because we're often thinking about lower dimensional objects, brains, in our universe. So we also kind of delved a little bit into black holes, both just sort of trying to talk about practicalities, looking at geodesics of Kerr, and then moving on and talking about extending black holes into higher dimensions and talking about thermodynamics. So that's kind of, you know, a survey of what we've done in the last nearly 3 weeks. And what we've been doing in the lectures is mostly theory because basically, if you're going to talk and chalk or put stuff on a board, then you want things that you can write down or that you can at least do in some finite amount of board space. But of course, gravity is also an experimental science. It's not just a cool thing that goes into an app on your smartphone, tells you where you are, but it's also becoming very much something that we test in the world we live in. So we test gravity both within the solar system, which you saw with Neil. We test gravity in cosmology, which you're about to see with David. But we actually also test gravity in the lab. Not only do we do experiments where we're kind of testing the details of gravity or things that underlie gravity, like the equivalence principle, there's actually new ideas coming from atomic physics where maybe we can test gravity by using cold atoms and superpositions of states. And I think that's kind of quite a nice sort of exciting frontier looking at sort of quantum physics, things that are really deeply quantum mechanical but are extended over space and time. This means that we can start to test gravity in that arena as well. So, Lots of exciting things. So I thought I'd pick on two, as I said. One more experimental and one very theoretical. So when I did perturbation theory, I talked about gauge issues. So I'd like to just go back and review that again and just give a bit of a cursory discussion about gravitational waves. Because what I've done at the end is I've got which hopefully will work, a short presentation with a few movies, some of which I've kind of been talking about over the course of the series and suggested that you know, maybe looked at or Googled. So, you know, it's just a sort of way to finish off without manically scribbling things down, at least hopefully anyway. So we talked about the perturbation equations for a metric. What was the perturbation around a background? And we derived the Lichnerowitz operator. So I'm just going to talk really a little bit about Well, I'll start off by talking about gravitational waves in the context of a linearized prescription. I'll give a simple example of a gravitational wave that goes beyond linear level, and then what we're going to see, or hear rather, I hope, in the presentation is going to be what people actually do when they're sort of trying to guess what a gravitational wave might look like in the detectors, okay? So this was what we got. This curved space wave operator had to vanish for a pure gravitational perturbation. And we also saw that under a coordinate transformation, we got a perturbation of the metric. So at the time, I didn't really delve into that. I just want to say a bit more about that now, because I think it's kind of important to think about gauge and gravity. How do we identify physical modes from gauge modes? So we saw that if we took a coordinate transformation, the change in the metric was proportional to the symmetrized derivative of psi. In other words, the lead derivative of the metric along psi. So that's how the metric changes. And so the change in our h bar is going to be that lead derivative of the metric around psi, that's h psi, minus half the trace. So that's what our H-bar is coming from the perturbation due to a change of coordinates. So if I now take the divergence of this object, you see that you get the wave operator acting on my coordinate transformation generator, psi, plus these double covariant derivatives. But what you notice is you can write this as grad A, grad B, minus grad B, grad A of the covector psi. So we can use the Riemann identity. To reduce that, those second two terms down to something, again, that's identifiable. So here we have wave operator acting on covector plus Ricci on a covector. Now, this is actually a well-posed differential equation. So it means that if we're given an initial data surface, so we take a Cauchy surface and we give initial data for psi on that surface, and so in other words, psi of 0 and psi dot of 0, whatever, we can then evolve that forward into a solution for psi given a source. So what that means is that if this last term is not zero initially, I can kind of use it as a source term for that wave equation, solve for psi, and then do the coordinate transformation with psi to cancel off this non-zero term. So it's telling us that this term can be considered a gauge term. We can get rid of it altogether. So that's the idea. So therefore, this is our new perturbation. And it satisfies the fact that the divergence of this H-bar vanishes, and this is called the de Donda gauge. So we usually choose it if we don't really have any obvious other symmetry or other physical reason for choosing a different gauge. And the reason that we choose it is fairly clear. If I look at the Lichnerowicz operator, the first term is what I expect, wave operator acting on H. The next two terms are genuinely geometric terms. They're terms that are telling me I'm in a curved space. And so the last term's the only one that's kind of a bit of a mess. And so if I can get rid of it, that's kind of good news, because then everything that's left is just looks like a corrected wave equation. So that's why I might want to do this. You don't always want to take this gauge, because sometimes there might be a gauge in which H is particularly simple. And even though you have the price of working this thing out, overall everything's easier in a different gauge. So, you know, it's as always, coordinates are always the thorn, if you like, in the side of doing gravity. So what happens now, our remaining gauge freedom so our gauge transformation is generated by some vector field. And I can still make a coordinate transformation, provided the wave, this generalized wave equation, acting on my new coordinate transformation chi, vanishes. So if I do that coordinate transformation, if there's such a chi, then I'm still okay. Now, this thing is, as I say, a wave equation. There's four components of chi, so there's four equations here. So here, in four dimensions, so in d dimensions, it has d solutions. So there's potentially, there are d solutions to that equation of motion. So let's now just take stock of what we've done here. We started off by saying that we had a perturbation. So that was when we first looked at perturbation theory. And so we said that we have some HAB, but it could be anything. And so H is symmetric, so that means that there are d into d plus 1 over 2 components of H. So that's how many degrees of freedom we start with. We've now got our gauge condition. And I said there were d solutions to that. So this gives us, if I look at this set of equations, it gives us a set of constraints. So it means I can pick d of my components of H and look at those equations and rewrite those chosen components in terms of what's left. In terms of what's left after I've done that, I've then got the Kaye gauge transformation, which tells me that of what's left, I've got D gauge degrees of freedom. So, pulling all that together, I start off with D into D plus 1 over 2, different independent degrees of freedom. I kill off D of them from my gauge choice. I'm left with D that are still gauge. So the physical degrees of freedom I end up with this expression. So it's D into D minus 3 on 2. So for example, if we're in four dimensions, we have 2 degrees of freedom, 5 dimensions, we have 5. So it's a bit like electromagnetism, isn't it, really, in four dimensions in terms of two polarization states. So we'll see these by a direct example. So in four dimensions, I'm just going to suppose initially that there's a metric of this form. It's like flat space TRXY, but then I've got this null piece, DT minus DR, or pseudo-null, it isn't really, which is pre-multiplied by a function H, and I'm not going to assume H is small. So once again, we do our Cartan, we say that omega t is dt plus a half h dt minus dr. Omega r is similar. I'm just calling it h. So, I mean, for the moment, I'm just sort of, you know, going forward. So, there's actually not much to be done here. If you stare at it, you'll see it does actually work. If I want to, clearly this is giving me nothing. The only thing when I take a derivative is going to be from these second terms here. And so d omega t is going to equal d omega r. So I just do one differentiation there, and I've done everything. So I only have my theta ti is a half h I omega t minus omega r, and that's also equal to ri. Everything else vanishes. And then because we've only got two non-zero one forms, it's sort of obvious that theta wedge theta is always going to be zero because you're taking a wedge product of two forms that are identical. And so the only non-zero curvature components come from D of these objects. So once again, RTI is the same as RRI, and it's just D of this thing. And so I get my curvature two forms, and I read off the fact that there's only two non-zero components of the Ricci tensor, and they're both proportional, both equal to a half of the Laplacian, two-dimensional Laplacian acting on H. So we've got a vacuum solution if H satisfies a two-dimensional Laplace equation. So if I just take, for simplicity, two linearly independent solutions and compute the curvature tensor. So this is going to tell me, Hij tells me about the Riemann tensor. So this is the tidal tensor. These are tidal forces. And so here you see that what happens to x, the inverse happens to y. So if x gets bigger, y gets smaller. And so what that means is that if I look at what happens to a circular distribution of matter, it's kind of made ablate along the x-axis and then on the y-axis. So that's one polarization state. And then the other sort of linearly independent solution I could have is something that looks like xy. And here, things scale in the x and y directions simultaneously. So we kind of get our circle distorting in a diagonal fashion. So these are the two polarization states of a gravitational wave. So that's just sort of, you know, a quick overview of doing linearized gravity and an example of an exact solution that represents a propagating gravitational wave in the r direction. So in reality, what happens if you want to do gravitational wave physics? Well, mostly you're either wanting to look at a given source and maybe do things semi-analytically, so you're often looking at a linearized problem. This will work if what you're looking at is not too strong, there isn't too much strong gravity going on. So, for example, I talked about those domain wall solutions. So objects like that, we can also have string solutions. Those objects are relatively, you know, mild in terms of not having strong gravity. And so it's not a bad approximation to use linearized gravity to compute gravitational wave signals from those objects or, you know, from particular events in their motion. So that's one thing that you can do. However, if you really want to get to the nitty-gritty and want to actually find out like what happens when there's a sort of dramatic astrophysical event, like a merger of two black holes or two neutron stars. In that situation, although you may be able to describe certain limits, you know, do approximations, analytic approximations, say when the black holes are far apart or there's a big ratio between the one, the mass of one and the mass of the other. In the end, if you're looking at black holes or to objects, something very strongly gravitating, like a neutron star or black hole, that are very close together, you have to do the calculation numerically. So in that case, you have to worry about gauge. So there were two things that were kind of stymieing, if you like, numerical relativity for some years. Of course, initially it was the computational side of things, the fact that computers were, you know, essentially, you know, the size of a room and the, you know, a capability of, well, worse than a credit card calculator or something. But, you know, certainly since the early 90s, I think computers were up to the job. What really stymied people latterly was this idea of gauge. And so that was eventually cracked by that Pretorius, Franz Pretorius, that I was talking about when I talked about the evolution of the instability of black holes. And he, where he actually came up with a particular gauge, a harmonic gauge, for which you could actually do numerics and have confidence about what you were extracting in terms of physical observables. So, so he was the first guy to do these mergers. And so I'm going to, it's not actually his simulation, but now, you know, everybody's doing them, right? It's sort of, it's the same thing. Within a couple of years, it becomes sort of commonplace and everyday. So that's kind of what we can do on the board. And if you are interested in numerical aspects of relativity, then Franz's collaborator, Luis Lehner, is here at Perimeter. And he's also been extremely influential in computing gravitational wave signals. So you should go and talk to him. He'll probably curse me for that if he gets those of you going. Right, so I've talked about gravity and gauge. So now I just want to kind of invert the two and go to the other end of the spectrum. So this is kind of looking forward a little bit to the string theory course that you'll be getting. Is it in the next batch, David? Yeah. So I doubt he'll probably be talking about this aspect of string theory. I suspect he wants to do, you know, really honest to God, proper scattering amplitudes and real strings. But nonetheless, this is definitely an important arena in which gravity is being used in, you know, contemporary theoretical high energy physics. So it's in the context of string theory. And, you know, we all sort of hear the mantra, string theory is quantized gravity. Well, you know, to an extent, yes, it's certainly given us a perturbative finite description of the graviton in terms of a spin 2 particle that's been taken into the quantum fold. But it's actually done a bit more than that. We can think about what our description of space-time is from the perspective of string theory. So the coordinates of our space-time now become fields living on a string. And so we can then ask, what are the consistency conditions for those fields, you know, the geometry that's generated by these fields, these X's. And it turns out that the consistency conditions for this transverse geometry look like Einstein equations. They're not quite, there's some extra massless fields in there, but it's very like Einstein gravity. And in fact, it turns out to be what we recognize as supergravity. So it's what people were doing, you know, way back in the day, immediately after sort of supersymmetry was invented, when they sort of thought, oh, good, we can quantize gravity. So initially, you know, everybody was sort of looking at finding gravitinos, sort of finding the complete spectrum with varying numbers of supersymmetry relations. So what we have here is I already wrote down this higher dimensional solution. So you should really regard this is more of a taster, because I don't think I can really cover this in 15 or 10 minutes or whatever it's going to be in the end. I made a mistake. I think those should be square roots. My notes are wrong. So I wrote down a solution for a D3 brain, maybe not in precisely this form, but I probably wrote it down in terms of a horizon radius, which was this top line here. So instead of doing that, I've kind of written it down in more sort of stringy things. You'll see what this G is. It's the string coupling. You see what alpha prime is. It's like the tension of the string. It gives you a length scale. And this is a solution to this consistent background for a certain type of string theory. So let's just take a look at what happens. We usually, when we're thinking about black holes or black brains, we want to identify where key surfaces are, so things like the event horizon. So if I ask, where is an event horizon? Well, that would be, it's not always where GTT goes to zero, as we know from Kerr, but there's no rotation here. So it's probably going to be where GTT goes to zero. So where is that? If rho goes to zero, this thing starts to blow up. So this is dominant in here. And then I have to take the square root and invert it. So in fact, rho goes to zero is where GTT goes to zero. So if I look near rho goes to zero, sorry, this should be an omega here, not an x. Okay, so just a bit of explanation about what's going on in this thing. We saw charged black hole solutions. And I mentioned that typically extended solutions in string theory were charged with respect to higher form fields, which was why they were extended. In this case, this solution is charged with respect to some self-dual field strength, phi form. And you have, it's also extremal in the sense that the charge is somehow equal to the mass. So this is, these are the properties of this solution. So then you might say, is there a fundamental unit of charge in the sense of one of these D brains? And the answer is yes. And the fundamental unit of charge is sort of one of these things here. That's this bit. So the N is meant to represent the fact that we've got, this has got N units of fundamental charge. Okay? So that's what the N's doing there. We then define this top thing as like the horizon radius. So L is sort of the analogy of what was the horizon radius. So it's a length scale that's associated with this horizon or where this metric goes to zero. So now let's have a look at what we've got near this so-called horizon. We've got a five sphere, this piece, which has a fixed radius, L. And then we have this prefactor, which is actually anti-de Sitter space. So you can sort of see why it has to be anti-de Sitter, because, crudely speaking, this whole thing ends up having to be in the near horizon regime approximately flat. So if this thing's positively curved, what's left has to be negatively curved. Sort of a bit hand wavy, but something like that. So the, again, without any explanation, it's just a sort of overview or a taster. The idea behind this gauge gravity correspondence, spoken from the perspective of a gravitational physicist, If we look at very large N, that means that length scale is big, and we kind of are in a not too strongly curved regime. So what does that mean in the context of where this whole story was coming from? If the space-time curvature isn't too big, it's then a good approximation to describe it as a sort of manifold with coordinates, real coordinates, with these metric functions, and as a solution to something like Einstein equations. So we can do kind of classical gravity with some measure of confidence. But on the other side of things, if we now go back to thinking of our strings and the fact that this space-time is just a set of fields, the X fields, if you like, living on the string, what is this D-brain? This D-brain is actually, its name comes from D equals Dirichlet. The D-brain is a place on which open strings end. And as a surface, it has various degrees of freedom. It can have gauge fields living on it because, as you'll see, the ends of open strings have gauge factors associated with them. And it also, there are other degrees of freedom corresponding to the motion of the D-brain in the transverse direction. So the D-brain itself, from a stringy perspective, has an effective action. Or an effective gauge theory. And so this is what gives rise to this so-called CFT. So there's two sides you can view this object. There's the side that you'll get introduced to in when you actually look at string theory, you'll be looking at it as a surface on which strings end, and you'll see that that surface has an effective CFT living on it. On the other hand, we can look at it from a gravitational perspective. We have these solutions in string theory, and they have pretty much the same sort of properties that you would expect of one of these Dirichlet surfaces. And so the identification was made that these two different ways of describing these objects, that the objects were the same, therefore the two different ways of describing them should be the same or equivalent. So that means that in some sense, if we do things in the context of classical gravity, they should have a counterpart in the context of this field theory. So that's just, again, a sort of skeleton, you know, executive summary. Yep. Yeah.
Is that metric a DC brain embedded in a 10-dimensional space?
Sorry, is the metric?
So that metric over there, is a DC brain embedded in 10 dimensions?
Did you say, is it a D3 brain embedded in 10 dimensions?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the metric. The thing I've written down at the top is a solution to supergravity in 10 dimensions. And it is what we are saying is the D-brain, which is the Dirichlet brain that strings end on. This is a solution to the low-energy effective field theory that we get from string theory for our space-time geometry. And this is something, you know, that we get when we look at consistent boundary conditions for our string ends. So the D3 brain lives in 10 dimensions, but if we take this limit, this near horizon limit, and just for now we jettison that S5, what we're left with is ADS5. And so this idea is that this ADS5, if we do something in the ADS5, it's kind of leaving an imprint on the surface of the D-brain, which is four-dimensional. So we have this idea of holography. Higher dimensional space-time, do classical gravity in it, and it kind of projects, leaves a sort of imprint on a four-dimensional screen, which is meant to be the CFT. So let me just tell you a little piece of ADS magic. Sorry, just trying to... In this case, I've just tried to sort of pick on things that I think are sort of quite neat, you know, in terms of each things to see. So one thing I thought was neat that we could do definitively was talk about something called the Brighton-Lohner-Friedman bound, because this is kind of something that underlies physics of ADS. So you might think that a scalar field with an imaginary mass or a negative mass squared would be a very bad thing to look at, okay? So let me just look at this in a general dimension, ADS. And I just want to redefine my coordinate. So that when I'm moving away from this horizon, as rho gets large, my new coordinate goes to zero. So my wave equation, and I'm just going to really look at the kind of TZ pieces because I want to peel out the essence of what's going on. This is my wave equation. So now I want to just solve it, basically. So I'm going to let phi be some power of alpha times psi. This is a sort of useful trick if you ever have to solve wave equations. So why did I do that? To be honest, when you try and solve for field equations, you're typically kind of, what you're trying to do is you're trying to separate variables, find eigenfunctions so you can find the Green's function. And there's really just a small number of canonical differential equations that you come across. In this case, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get something. What I've noticed is I've got here I've got phi double dot times z squared, here I've got just a constant times phi, and then I've got phi double prime pieces, and I'm kind of seeing this is sort of in the right shape for a Bessel equation, but not quite there yet. It's got the wrong coefficients. So I rescale phi in order to choose this exponent to get a Bessel equation here. So if alpha is d minus 1 over 2, what I get So basically, if I look at a Fourier mode for my psi, what I've now got is a Bessel type of equation, and so I can write down my solution for my scalar field. And that is a regular solution. But notice because I'm adding this dimension dependent piece here, it allows m squared to actually be negative. So I can have a regular solution to my wave equation with a negative mass squared. So normally you have, you know, a negative mass squared, you think you have something called a tachyon, which kind of gives rise to instabilities in the solution for your field. Now here I'm just doing this in a very cursory fashion to indicate where, you know, if you find, you've sort of seen this, if we find a solution to linearized equations with a phase e to the I omega t, where omega is imaginary, that signals an instability because you have an exponentially growing mode. So normally in flat space, an imaginary mass would give you an imaginary omega, but it doesn't here. So you have a different relationship between omega and m, which allows to have a negative mass squared. So because ADS is negatively curved, it kind of acts like a box, something that confines. And so we know that typically any solution to a wave equation has a wavelength. And so if you put it in a box, you can only have wavelengths that are shorter than the size of the box, which means that if an instability is very long wavelength, it can be cut off by putting a system in a box. And that's basically what ADS does. And so what it means is that we can have interesting solutions with negative, or sort of what look like negative mass scalars in ADS. So a particular example that people kind of look at is a charged scalar with negative mass squared. And they look at it in the background of a black hole, or rather a black plane. And so this black plane has a temperature, which is proportional to the horizon value. And what happens is, if the black hole is quite large, so it has a fairly high temperature, then you find that the scalar field just sort of will stay in a sort of equivalent of a, I can use the word now, false vacuum state. But as T gets lower, we see that we get distinctly different solutions for our scalar. So So we have a solution. I'm just going to put it over here since I'm nearly finished with what I want to say. So we have a solution that looks asymptotically like this, as so z goes to 0. And basically, this phi 2 is sort of gives a U1 symmetry on the boundary. This mu, something we basically it's a charged black hole. And then if we just fix all the boundary values of the other components to A to 0, we find that we have an interpretation either as a superfluid or as a superconductor if we don't have other components of A vanishing. So this system in the bulk has features that look like superconductors or superfluids. So this is like our phi 2. It has a sort of phase transition as we lower the temperature of the black hole. So that's just a quick, let's see if this works. It's not going to work now. It worked before. No. Right, so I've just given you a couple of things that I sort of think are interesting from two very polar different ends of the spectrum of where gravity research is being undertaken at the moment. And projector's warming up. And so what I now want to do is just kind of, I've selected a few images which I think kind of summarize some of the things that we've been learning about from a more analytic perspective. And I want you to see what we can do when we actually look at gravity in a more general and, you know, comprehensive way. See, it snows in Britain too. That's in the background as... you know, a view from my bedroom window in Durham. Right, this first one is why, you know, we talked about black holes and a lot of what we've done, you know, it all looks very clean when you write it down on a blackboard, right? So how do we have confidence that black holes are out there? Well, I guess to some extent there's an element still of supposing that, you know, Einstein gravity or something very close to it is our theory of gravity. But I think this slide is showing a real evidence, you know, really sort of compelling evidence for the black hole. Let's see if I can play it again. Nope. There. So what you see is over a number of years, which are appearing in the top corner, you see that we've been observing the center of our galaxy, and all of those lines are meant to aid the eye there where the observers have been tracking individual stars. And this one here, SO2, is in a particularly eccentric orbit. And you see it just whip round this object at the center of our galaxy. So the mass that we deduce that this thing has is about 1 million solar masses, roughly. And it's sort of in a tiny, you know, confined to a really tiny region of space. So that's kind of a really nice long-term, you can see over many years, set of observations that really nail down the fact that at the core of many galaxies, we find supermassive black holes. This is, I thought I would advertise what some people at Perimeter are doing. Avery Broderick, so again, if you're interested, you can go talk to him, is involved in a global collaboration to actually try and image this black hole at the center of the galaxy using radio telescopes across the world. So by using telescopes at different parts of the globe, you actually get a huge baseline, which of course helps with resolution. So the idea is they're seeing stuff as it gets gobbled up by the black hole. So here is a simulation. I mentioned this before. The green is the equatorial plane. And this is saying, you know, what would something look like, a flare, as something was being sucked in? So a localized flare of something disappearing into a black hole. Remember I said light bends around the black hole. Here you see, let's get the proper pointer. Here you actually see the, you know, this spreading out of the image. And this is typical of an imaging of a black hole. So you're obviously not seeing the black hole directly. What you're seeing is the pattern of this enormously strongly lensed light that has made it out from the black hole as something has been swallowed. So this is, you know, one region, you know, in order to get this image, you've got to track all those geodesics out from this very strong gravitational regime. So that's kind of some nice application of numerics in black holes, yep.
What kind of timescale was this?
Oh, you'd have to ask Avery. Sorry about that. I just thought it was a cool animation, you know. I guess, so typically, I guess, one thing, but let's do an estimate, right? Because this black hole is, what, a million times the solar mass weight mass. So the solar black hole would be 3 kilometers big. So this is 3 million kilometers big. So basically, things that happen towards the end are going to be, you know, on that sort of, if, you know, 3 million kilometers, turn that into, you know, how many light seconds takes for a light crossing time. Obviously, it's going to be longer than that, but it's not going to be... Okay, let's cross my fingers that Avery gives you the same story if you ask him. So, moving to gravitational wave experiments. These are a few slides nabbed from the sort of LIGO folks. We've got ground-based interferometers. You know, gravitational waves, I'm really hoping that this is what we're going to hear big news about this year. There's been rumors floating around for a few months now that they've seen a detection, but we haven't heard anything concrete. And my guess is the guys, first of all, they want to be sure. They don't want to mislead us. And then the other thing is they know that there are a few little, like, Maxwell demons sitting around, sort of, who can inject a false signal into their, you know, into their data that they're analyzing. So, you know, they don't even know when they find it, if it's real or not, till they open the envelope, you know, to see, haha, just fooled you guys. You know, and sadly, that's happened a couple of times. It also tests that they're doing the data analysis properly, you know, they're actually finding things. Anyway, these are the sort of ways in which we can deduce the gravitational waves. We've got pulsar timing arrays. We can sort of see if something kind of spins down. That's due to loss of energy from gravitational radiation. Maybe we'll be able to build space-based interferometers. But just to sort of say what the LIGO guys are doing, you know, they're actually looking for, here we see one of this plus polarization state. So here's that little picture that I sketched on the board. And they're looking for this sort of variation in distances. So that's kind of what they're trying to see. And it's a really tiny effect, order 10 to the minus 21 or so. So the setup is kind of like a sort of Michelson-Morley type experiment, except we're not trying to detect the ether, something as easy as the motion of the Earth around the Sun. Here we're trying to detect an effect that's down to the order of 10 to the minus 21, which is pretty impressive levels of sensitivity. So again, from this Pilfert's slides, this is showing that gravitational waves is a global community, and you know that it's sort of a fairly nice bunch of guys generally. So they're claiming that early detection looks feasible. So we shall see. We shall see. I think they're supposed to release data soon. Right. This is what I hope the sound's going to work. So this is from Bernard Schutz's webpage. The people working on this like to liken the gravitational wave signal to sounds rather than light. So if you listen, I hope please work. Is the sound coming in? No, it didn't work. Oh, there it did, just very work quietly from my laptop. Oh dear, never mind, that didn't work. So it's a very characteristic slow burn, right, for a long, long time, until right when the two black holes are kind of going fast around each other, it goes whoop, so into this little chirrup. So, that didn't work. Sorry about that. So to go on to this idea now, completely changing gear in the formal end, going back to thinking about these scalar fields, the background scalar condensate in and of itself is not, you know, so much intrinsic interest. What's interesting is what you can then do on that background and play with. So we talked about domain walls. This is an example of a vortex instead of a domain wall. You can make a sort of winding in your scalar field, a solution that has a winding number, and that looks like a vortex. So here's a sort of image of, here's the AT that was on the board. This is like a rescaled scalar field that was on the board, but we introduce an additional component of the gauge field inside the space-time that's kind of there because of this varying phase. So that's like the profile of a vortex, and then numerically, you can look at what happens. So here's the horizon, and here's the boundary. This is where we would say there's a superfluid, and you see there's a vortex-antivortex pair that's gradually moving. This is what you expect vortices and antivortices to do. You expect them to move perpendicular to their direction of motion. So that's kind of a little animation showing the direct correspondence between the bulk and what's happening to our fields in the bulk, and then the boundary theory that should be that of some quantum superfluid. And here's something even more dramatic, if it works, but it's very slow, where somebody's set up an array of tons and tons of vortices where you can now study turbulence and scaling in this superfluid that lives on the boundary. And so that's something else that's kind of, I would say, although people, you know, claim to have done it, I think there's a lot of unanswered issues that go on there. So I'm going, since that's a very, very long video, I'm simply going to stop it, quit, show you one of my beautiful photographs, and I'll end there. So we've kind of gone from one end of the spectrum to the other today, and of course in the course we've kind of done a similar thing. So I hope you've kind of, maybe, you know, some of the more formal bits are less to your liking than some of the less formal bits, but or vice versa. But hopefully, overall, there's been something for, you know, something for everyone during the course. And well done. You've got to the end. Thank you.
Thank you, and a new car.
Right, there we go. A new color. I've got a whole sort of array of these. This is quite, you know. So this is red now. Way. You ever going to have pink? Come on. Okay, thanks.